Oh, Captain, My Captain by Walt Whitman.
Oh, Captain, My Captain, our fearful trip is done.
The ship has weathered every rack. The prize we sought is won.
The port is near, the bells I hear, the people all exulting.
While follow eyes the steady keel, the vessel grim and daring.
But oh, heart, heart, heart.
Oh, the bleeding drops of red.
Where on the deck my captain lies.
Fallen, cold, and dead.
Oh, captain, my captain, rise up and hear the bells.
Rise up, for you the flag is flung, for you the bugle trills.
For you bouquets and ribbon wreaths, for you the shores are crowding.
For you they call, the swaying mass, their eager faces turning.
Dear captain, dear father.
This arm beneath your head.
It is some dream that on the deck you've fallen cold and dead.
My captain does not answer, his lips are pale and still.
My father does not feel my arm, he has no pulse nor will.
The ship is anchored safe and sound, its voyage closed and done.
From fearful trip, the victor ship comes in with object won.
Exult, O shores, and ring, O bell.
But I, with mournful tread,
walk the deck my captain lies.
Fallen, cold, and dead.
Real Poets is an audio-only podcast that can also be visually read, like roses. Or when a director juxtaposes his or her most imposing reposes with characters, settings, and themes. Composed of thrilling soundscapes, highest of stakes, and dreams. Hosted by a duo of real poets about real poets and the real poetry they've written and the films that have been written about them and their work.
Join us each week as we talk to another real poet with something to say and how a real poetry movie influenced them in some way. Then we each write a new poem inspired by our most recent viewing of the film and share it with all of you.
Welcome, everyone, to Real Poets. I'm Renzo, joined by the always effervescent Scott Raven with three T's. And today we have an extremely special guest.
Hi, I'm Debbie Wanninghoff. I guess I am a person who has written poetry for many years, but has gotten a lot more serious about it in the past couple of years. And have started a poetry share in the place where I live, Key Biscayne, Florida. And I have met Renzo and Scott in the past year or so at open mics. And it's a pleasure to know you and to be invited.
I think you're being modest. I consider you, since the time that I've met you, you're just a linchpin in terms of the Miami poetry scene with the work that you do in Key Biscayne. You're so open with gathering poets, making, even offering your home to make it a place of gathering and connection. So I am extremely happy you're here because you are joining us for Dead Poets Society. As somebody who works in education, and Scott, I'd like you to chime in on this too. I'm just incredibly excited to get your perspective on this film that I loved for years. I haven't rewatched in maybe a decade, and I'm smitten all over again, and this time with deeper layers of meaning. Scott?
Yeah. I mean, definitely looking back at the different periods with which having watched this film, being, you know, a student, I guess I was maybe a high school student upon first seeing it, and then now having, you know, been an educator, still a student of the world, seeing it through those eyes and not realizing a lot of the time the impact that it had on me, even subconsciously. You know, there was something that I was thinking about with the movie where I might have been influenced by other people who has seen the movie rather than the movie itself too. And I think that happens with a great movie as well, that where people have also seen the movie, they've gone on to do things that have then inspired them to do something that then inspired, you know, me. I didn't make the direct connection to it. We'll talk a little bit more of that later. But yes, to underscore what Renzo's saying, pleasure to have you here, Debbie. Children's book author, mom. I believe you got two new cats as well. Is this true?
Yes. Two new kitties, Blue and Rotini, and they are sweet and very active, but they do take cat naps once in a while.
Oh, nice. Before talking a little bit about your experiences as a teacher, what I'm interested in is, you know, let's take it back to when you were a student and you first, you know, you in English classes, you in the arts. What did hold your attention when you were a student in high school, even early college, maybe experiences in a writing class or any of that sort of thing?
Wow, it just popped into my head that in ninth grade, in Mr. Iwanski's English class, he opened our minds through literature, and he was very interested in my involvement with music, and he was actually asked to interview me on a local radio station. I played the violin, and he asked me questions about my future in music, and it was kind of fun, and I did go on to music school in college and became a music teacher, and just his interest and his curious spirit were a driving force to me. Yeah.
Right. Was there any, I guess, teaching methods or something from like one of those classes that maybe you took on yourself, either a way of teaching or a particular exercise, you know, that maybe underlined some of the principles of how you teach?
Really? I can think of Mr. Iwanski in high school, and then I can go on to college and I can't remember the professor's name. And he was giving us all kinds of essays and short stories to read. It was an early class, telling us to wake up, asking us all kinds of questions that really got us to think. That spurred me on to teach that way with my students, to get them to think about the deeper meaning of something. So
nice. Through music, what tend to be kind of your entry into the arts a little bit more. Can you remember what was your introduction to poetry? What was your gateway into poetry?
My gateway into poetry, although I didn't really think about it at the time, it would be song lyrics. When I started teaching, I taught in 10 schools. It sounds crazy, but I was the roving strings teacher in the Clarkstown Central School District in Rockland County, New York. And I did two schools each day, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. And we had lots of celebrations in those schools for teachers who were getting married or having babies or retiring. For some reason, I honed in on these celebrations and started writing lyrics to tunes that were already tunes. Like, I remember this one PE teacher, she loved this the series MASH. I wrote a little blurb. She gave them the awareness of safety, skills, and fairness. We know she made a difference in their lives. So I would yes, just retrofit song lyrics.
I have two questions that I want to go on, but the first one that I have is, you are very passionate about poetry from the day that I met you, right? And again, you host poets in your home, you surround yourself with poetry, you are an advocate for poetry in your community, in our community. Why? What role does poetry play in your life that inspires you to do these things and reach out, continuously reach out and put effort to it, I imagine, every day?
I believe in the value of every person's voice. When I meet someone who has a story and has put that into a poem, I celebrate that. I really do. Also, poetry has been a way of grieving for me. You know that I lost my son in 2015 because of a cell phone distracted driver. And I just started writing poems to express my grief, a lot of haikus. I wrote a book of haikus for him. Just hearing other poets and hearing their hearts just moves me. It just moves me, yeah. I've always been a person with a lot of empathy. I've always been a person who could just watch Lassie and cry. I cry
Same.
Everything.
Same.
Yeah. I think just the expression of your inner self, my inner self, it allows you a freedom that other things do not. Yeah.
And you mentioned heartbeat, and I think of beats and your background in music, and then I think of poetry and meter. And I'm just trying to think, do you find a connection, or do you find it easier to relate because of the musicality of the words?
Yeah.
It's very rare to find a medium like poetry where you can find the skill that it takes. It's almost like sculpture in a way, when you see it on the page and you see the grammar and the syntax and the syncope and just seeing how it plays out and it shapes this word. But in music, you do the same thing as you're building a melody. And I'm wondering if you find a link between those things, and that's why you're so drawn to it with your background.
Actually, I don't think so. Yeah. Isn't that strange to say?
No. Yeah, of course.
Maybe it's music to my ears. But it's total free form. I have a hard time writing in rhyme. Friends have told me, you need to go to Rene Latupi's rhyme school because your meter, everything is off. Yeah. So I just put out what my heart is telling me in free verse. I love alliteration. That is one thing I do very much love. And Scott mentioned my children's book published 2 years ago. And it is very much a poem that alliteration is profuse on every page. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm sure the music is in my head and it comes out some way, but I don't really think of the connection so much.
Right. It's almost an inverse. I mean, I relate a lot to what you're saying of, you know, it's the constraint of sometimes the beat doesn't allow the full expression of the heart, where you want to go off on tangents. You want to zig and zag and go diagonally, where if you're following sometimes a meter, you can't fully open up. Now, there is something to be said for literary constraints can increase your creativity because you're mining for the word. But can, you know, an emotion, be contained within structure? And, you know, that this ties a little bit to the opening, I guess, of the movie that we're talking about today, of Dead Poets Society, and powerful opening scenes. We can start to kick it off where they tear the kind of the rubric out of the anthology. If Renzo, you wanted to talk a little bit about set that scene up for us a little bit.
Sure. So I'll do that, but let me first just give a quick overview of Dead Poets Society. So it was directed by Peter Weir, an Australian director who, Scott, you called out, The Truman Show, did Witness with Harrison Ford, the Lear of Living Dangerously, Master and Commander. Great director. I believe he nominated multiple times for an Academy Award, but I think he got the Lifetime Achievement Academy Award in 2022. It stars Robin Williams, and one of my favorite roles that he played, I think that Robin Williams, when he was at his best, there was nobody better in terms of acting, right? Also as a stand-up, obviously a writer. You have a young Ethan Hawke. This was his second movie, I believe his first one, I forget the title, but it was with River Phoenix and it wasn't a success. He stopped, and then at 18, he did this movie and now he's a respected actor. You also have Robert Sean Leonard. Anybody who's a fan of House will remember him. He's also been in several movies as well, and I can go on.
Theater actor. Josh Charles, I'll also mention.
Josh Charles of Scandal fame, The Good Wife fame, Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead fame. He's been around, also respected theater actor, and one of still best friends, or one of Ethan Hawke's best friends to this day, and they met at the audition for here. This group of kids are still good friends to this day. And it's interesting because when filming the movie, Peter Weir had all of the kids bond, and he filmed it chronologically to develop this relationship that we see. Yeah. The setting is 1959, Welton Academy, which is a prestigious all-boys prep school in Vermont. And it's interesting because it took place in 1959. The movie was shot in 1989. And now it's not 2019, it's 2025, but it's almost 30 years after. So there's 30-year increments that we see this develop. And in brief, it's a group of students that are awakened to the power of poetry and of personal expression by their unconventional English teacher, Mr. John Keating, it's played by Robin Williams, through the revival of the secret Dead Poets Society. They confront conformity, tradition, and the high cost of living authentically, right? So I just want to set that up. And then to go to the scene that you're talking about, Scott, this is the first time where they're getting down to do work. And the first thing he does is have them read from the introduction to the textbook for poetry. And he starts writing down quantifiable ways, a chart, a line graph of how to measure the impact of poetry. And then he tells them, rip it out. It's excrement. The character of Keating, the way that I interpret it, is he values individual thought and expression. Even later in the movie, when a kid comes up and says, I have a cat. And he does another line, right? A two-line poem. And he said, I don't care about brevity. He doesn't even fail him. He just says, be original. You're failing yourself. Be of substance. Contribute. This is your voice. Use it. So
yeah,
that's what
I think that part is beautifully handled. Yeah, that interaction of seeing that in class as a teacher so many times of someone, it's not they're not even putting the effort. He's not reducing it. He's not shutting him down, so he's not going to create. But he holds him, you know, to task, saying, yeah, you can write about that, but put something more into that. And you can tell the difference too between somebody. You can have a silly poem. You can have a one line poem. You can have a one word poem. But if you know. You can tell.
Let it be your voice. Let it be your voice. And Debbie, this is one of the reasons I asked you that question about meter and rhyme and stressing it, is he's taking this quantifiable way of reading poetry and saying, to hell with it. Remove this. Move away. Be qualitative. What's the quality of it? And I'm wondering how this scene hit you. What did you think of this scene as you're seeing somebody like, a book is sacred to some people. For me, I would die if I rip one of the pages out of that library behind me. What feelings did this bring up in you as you're watching this scene?
I just said, God bless Mr. Keating. I just felt, yes, yes. You are changing lives today. You are changing perspective today. Mm-hmm. Wow. Those boys will never forget.
Did you ever have to grade people on a music performance?
No. Or
how was it assessed as a teacher?
Gosh.
Was it like...
Isn't that strange that I would not remember that after 9 years of teaching fourth through sixth graders violin? I think it was just a pass-fail that I remember that... Wow. Yeah, that's escaping me, the whole rubric of that. But
right. Because yeah. You know, I've taken poetry classes where they've been graded. Obviously, you had to, you know, put together a final project. There was always that. You know, it makes me think, you know, if we're thinking contemporarily of slam in particular, where poems are literally scored from 0 to 10. Now, there's a motto within slam, the points are not the point, the point is poetry. And it's hard to score really something. And you have to go in with kind of with that attitude. It's just a way to gain attention to it. I know I'm jumping around a little bit, you know, we talked music. I wanted to hear a little bit from you, Debbie, too, about what role film plays for you too, just because this is a, you know, real poetry. It is poetry on film. And there are poems in this movie and one, you know, early on or lines from one early on that we're watching delivered in a film. We're not reading them off the page yet. We're watching them being performed, but we're also watching them being filmed. Yeah, there's definitely a pivotal scene, Ethan Hawke's character, which we want to go into when he shares his first film to go off of the cat poem and how that differs. How did that kind of play for you of, okay, we're seeing a movie, we're watching a movie with poetry and you're in the role of maybe poetry or film for you. Do you generally watch, does film play a role? Do films resonate with you more than poems, as much as poems, music as well?
I would say a good film resonates with me in a very deep way, especially if the plot and the character development is done well and feels just right. Going to a symphony orchestra and hearing something of quality that is so moving that it's infinite, it's unexplainable what that does. And I feel the same about poetry, very much so, that it just moves me, a good poem. And that's, it moves me in a way that exposes something in humans or describes nature in a way like the poet Mary Oliver, who was one of my favorites, that is undescribable, really. So I don't know if I answered your question, but I went off on a little tangent there.
I want to stay on this scene a little longer because I think it presents one of the central theses of the movie. At first, it may seem to some people that Mr. Keating is advocating for anarchy, right? Like, be free of constraints, stay away from this society. But he's a classicist. He has a deep knowledge of the classics. He has a deep mastery of form, even when he's arguing, or not arguing, playfully bantering with the teacher, the Latin teacher, Mr. McAllister, who comes in when he's in his room as the kids are ripping up the books. And he's like, hey, what are you doing? And he's like, no, I'm teaching the class. And they have a discussion about unorthodox methods. McAllister uses poetry to say, like, you know, that you need these constraints. You can't have them be free thinkers now. It hurts them to be free thinkers. And he answers in verse, saying that you need to go for your dreams. And McAllister goes like, is that Thoreau? He's like, no, Keating. So he's somebody that can use classic form to show, at that time, right, contemporary ideas that expand and go beyond it. But then you have a character like Gail Hansen, the actor, played Charlie Dalton, the bad boy of the group. And he goes and he sends a letter without the consent of the rest of the Dead Poets Society, asking for girls to come to Walton, endangering the society. Yeah.
Was he Rwanda that he named himself?
No Wanda. No Wanda.
Which is great, where you see today people taking on the poetry moniker. That's a great name.
And he's Nwanda, right? And he ends up evolving by taking on the accountability himself, protecting the group instead of endangering them as the film progresses. But when Mr. Keating comes to see him, he said that was foolish because you didn't think. It's not like you're going into anarchy, is what he told him, right? And then he goes but he does silently approve of the spirit of it, saying if it was God calling collect, then it would have been.
Right.
I say all that to say that, you know, this movie asks a question. I have my own biases. I love classical poetry. I'm a classicist myself. Right now the project that I'm working on is going through all of these different types of poetic forms, but I'm imbuing them with contemporary language. I'm imbuing them with contemporary topics. And seeing if I can push the poetic form past what it was into something new. Are you someone who believes that we should do away with these constraints, or that constraints actually help you move forward? Are you somewhere in between? Where do you lie on that?
I would say somewhere in between, but mostly do away. That didn't make sense. Somewhere in between, but sort of. Yeah, I don't think that there should be anything that should limit your expression, although there are proven forms like the sonnet, which have, you know, the iambic pentameter and the certain, you know, 14 lines, and people will, well, Shakespeare swore by those. I like to invent forms myself to help children write poetry when they are reticent to do that. But I don't really feel that there should be forms that constrain you and constrain your word choice. But I do have fun writing haikus. I like the challenge of picking the perfect words. As far as my heart flow goes, I don't like to be constrained. No.
What about you, Scott? What about you? Because Shakespeare, when they talk about Shakespeare to the kids in the movie, there's an audible groan. And then Robin Williams goes into his improv shtick imitating John Wayne and all of that, making it accessible for them. Yeah. And we forget that Shakespeare was revolutionary in his time, away from the established norms, with this new rigid form sonnet. So Scott, where do you fall on this?
Yeah, well, the key point I was saying is that you have Robin Williams making it accessible. So the same classics performed or presented in a class without emotion or without passion, without even a deeper understanding, can fall upon deaf ears. The same kids could experience these poems and it just not connect with them, because there isn't somebody that is able to kind of find that way in. And I've had both those experiences. And that's a shame, because if you have an experience with poetry early on, that shapes how you relate to poetry. If you have early experience where someone is a little bit more drone about it, and, you know, they're not able to really relate a classical to something maybe that you're going on, it's there in the text, but if they're not able to do that, then you may, how many kids have you heard say, oh, I don't like poetry, so inaccessible, I don't even know what they're saying. You know, even for me, I knew there was gold in there, and I feel like you have to stand on the shoulders of those to make your own. And in the same way that Debbie, you know, you said you worked with parodies a lot, you know, in the song lyrics, you're using their shell. You know, there's something to be said for all stories have already been told, and you know, now we're putting the specificity in our own right. So it took me a while to come back to the classics. Till college, I was ready to hear them a little bit more. I like doing what you're doing too, writing my own versions of these classics. Robin Williams, yeah, he's using modern techniques with which to elicit the reactions from the students. I thought, I don't know if we met, like when he has them do the funny walks, that's taken from, you know, Monty Python, like kind of like the you know, these improv games or these kind of like theater games. Another thing I to underscore this, the active voice of poetry got me into it as well, and that's Shakespeare. Okay, you can take a classical text and I can put an objective behind this, or I can put an action attached to this, and it just brings it to life and understanding that when performed with an appropriate emotion, as Ethan Hawke's character did, wow, I might not even under, but I feel that, and I can understand it.
There's a scene that actually I think plays more than the Ethan Hawke scene that we'll talk about to highlight the point you're making, Scott. Remember, he's the soccer coach as well, right? Or he takes them out and he says, recite a verse and kick a soccer ball.
Yeah, I was just about to say
active. That. Please go ahead.
No. Well, that particularly really resonated with me coming from the athletic background. My drama teacher in high school, he actually allowed for our soccer team to, he kind of recruited us, and I recruited a couple of the other guys to do the Shakespeare play for that year. It was, you know, Much Ado About Nothing. And, you know, we had an arrangement that we could practice till 5 o'clock every day and then rehearsal 5 to 6. Kudos to that. That was my first, you know, introduction to doing a play. But, you know, taking kind of like, all right, these are these athletes that then got to emote and share emotions within a theatrical play. Mr. Martinek, I will give a shout out to.
You know, Deb, Scott and I were talking about this earlier with something that had to do with me. And I feel that I can perform poetry pretty well in terms of voice, but I'm not part of the slam culture. I'm dipping my toes into it now, and now I'm committing to it. But it's not something that comes easily to me. And I did used to do theater in college. I mentioned to Scott, I'm having trouble memorizing poems now when I perform, and I always read through them, but I did Waiting for Godot, right? So I was able to at one point. But the scene where Keating says, nothing like sports helps a human being exceed through through direct competition with other human beings, and having them read poetry while then like physically exerting themselves kicking that soccer ball is a concept that I'm actually dealing with now in terms of performance, right? Like when you read a poem, you can say, oh, captain, my captain, or oh, captain, my captain, right? Like bring it in and remember how to do it and enunciate. How does that play for you? Because I know that you've done a lot of and hosted a lot of performances.
Well, I think your whole being has to be into the delivery of your poem. All the pauses and inflections. Who are your listeners out there? Not that you would read it differently for one audience or another, but you can feel the energy. You can feel what they're longing for. And when I feel a real longing from the audience, I just put more of my physical being into that.
Yeah, right. That wave. And you know, yeah, the audience keeps you present within it. It's interesting, like the poems within the movie, there's lines. I guess there's not any, I don't know if there's any full poem kind of read within the movie.
It's yeah, just that kind of, really, that was my one thing I mentioned to my husband, that I wanted to hear more poetry.
The whole thing is poetry rather than, and hopefully, yeah you'll go in and engage. The scenes are replicas of all the poems that are alluded to, I guess, occur in the movie, you know. And if we can go through, I don't know if we can go through I think I have a list of all the poems that are in the movie. I think, you know, we have "O Captain, My Captain," which we started with,
which plays a huge role towards the end, right? And that's one of the reasons we chose to read it first. It's a bookend for what's going on in the movie.
That final scene is chilling. Yeah.
There's "She Walks in Beauty," Lord Byron. And I guess, you know, that connects with the one, I guess, problematic scene a little bit. the lustful affair. What's the character's name? The Josh Charles character.
Knox Overstreet. Like, that's a name that's straight out of a screenwriting class, I think. Knox Overstreet.
"The Road Not Taken" by Robert Frost appears in this. "To the Virgins," that's early on, which relatable to them. So there's also "Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day" that the character uses as if he had written it himself, if you remember, while they're in the cave. And talked a little bit about that during Love Jones, of whether or not you've ever quoted another or used your own poem. Let's say it's a love poem and you've performed it in front of a crowd and people are wooed by your words, but it's not necessarily written for those that may have been wooed by it while you're performing it. That's something that, you know, poets tend to do. They'll have that one love poem and then they just, you know, use it in all different venues and that sort of thing. But this is another level that he's claiming he was Will S., which is bold, and she was none the wiser. A quick note on "She Walks in Beauty," you know, that poem is always for some reason tied to my life and with my mom. And after my mother passed, my dad found that poem haunting him or following him everywhere. And, you know, like anytime he'd open a book, it would just be, you know, that poem. So that's always had a special place in my heart. Then there's all the poetry in "A Midsummer's Night Dream." I mean, that's filled with sonnets, filled with poets. "Walden" by Thoreau. Do any of you have any experience with Walden? You know, kind of retreating out into the woods. That's kind of the opening credo, I believe, that they have.
No, I love that poem. The poem's great.
And then "Ulysses" from Tennyson is in the movie as well. There may be a couple others.
There are some that I want to talk about because I want to talk about certain scenes, right? And not just the scenes, but I want to ask you guys, when you hear "O me, O life," that we referenced before, that you are here, that life exists and identity, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse, right? So we have this scene that's Carpe Diem versus conformity. This is their first meeting in typical Mr. Keating fashion. I can say that now. He walks in, starts whistling, walks out, hooks his head back in while the boys are all confused and says, "Come on then.
Do you know what he whistles? What he's whistling each time?" Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture.
It's a beautiful scene, right? Because I love the portraits that they use. So Mr. Keating shows the students photos of former Welton graduates, right? And this is taking place in 1959. The school is from the 1800s. So you're looking at portraits of people from the early 1900s, pre-World War II. And that's when he tells them, "Lean in, they're talking to you." And he whispers, "Carpe diem, seize the day, boys. Make your lives extraordinary." This mantra is what's repeated throughout the film, right? Carpe diem. This line that I just said is, I think, number 92, 93 on the AFI, American Film Institute's top most quoted line. It can be seen as a direct rejection of Welton's rigid values, right? They're four pillars: tradition, honor, discipline, and excellence. And the boy's willingness or inability to internalize this principle becomes a central arc in the film. It's tied into "O me, O life," which emphasizes a personal contribution to that powerful play that I mentioned of life. And Keating is using this to stir the boy's dormant purpose in a way. What do you guys think in terms of carpe diem versus conformity? I have my own thoughts that I'll save, but I'm curious, Debbie, what do you see? I mean, do you see are you making a moral judgment on the values of Welton versus the values that Keating is expressing of nonconformity and individual thought?
Yeah, well, I feel that Welton Academy was very afraid to open these boys' minds because they thought they would just go wild and crazy. And forget about thinking, discipline. Yeah, discipline. And the four values that you mentioned, I read that the four other values, beauty, love, truth, and justice, values that sustain life, can they survive the demands of societal acceptance and success? So here they are in this mold of conformity. They know what their lives are destined to be. And Keating opens their minds, and God bless Keating again.
Yes, I love it. That's going to be the title of that, just GBK.
Praise Keating. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you did.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, I think you did.
Yeah, okay. That's from your opinion as well, the mentioning those pillars and that sort of thing. Truth be told, I was a member of a fraternity in college. And there was a creed that the fraternity had, and it was to be a man of good character, a student of fair ambitions, of good moral character, all these things that, truth be told, not everybody followed, yet they were part of the brotherhood, that not every single, but, and I took these things kind of to heart, and that was the only amount of kind of like disciplining that I've had in my life. I do believe a certain amount of discipline is important so that you can become a better vessel for what it is you're meant to take in, what it is you have that calling for, I describe as I'm a live wire that, the stage for me is what plugs me in, and, needing something to be able to plug you in. So if somebody is completely, ramshackle, is there a fear that, they do go off the rails? And what is that to be off the rails,
Which is Dempsey, right? Dempsey represents that towards the middle.
Right. And that's a tricky balance. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you push too hard, that could lead to quite unfortunate circumstances. I just want to make a quick comment on carpe diem itself too. The phrase itself, at the time, I remember it started to become cliche. The idea of actually saying seize the day is a cliche. And it's more of, it's doing. You have that, but then what is that way with which you do obviously seize the day? So people don't go around shouting it. It just has to be exemplified in, And, the key moment, I can remember so many times of one, having a girl that I had a crush on and petrified to just dial her number, just not want to make, that like, and doing that, kind of dialing a couple digits and then hanging it up, and the reaching, reaching for a hand. And I think, at that time I did end up writing a piece for a girl that I had a crush on. It was unrequited, but I gave it to her, and
that's what mattered, right? That act mattered.
Right.
So for me, when I look at that scene, it's interesting because when I break it down, I think it's saying a couple of things. The first thing that I noticed is the way that while he's reading Oh Me, Oh My, or talking to them about Carpe Diem, you see the faces and the portraits of these generations, right? And it's saying like, they're the same as you. They cared about the same things you did. They just used a different language. And I see Mr. Keating as this Rosetta Stone between these generations with his understanding of classical poetry. We are talking about Shakespeare, but we're also talking about Whitman, right? We're talking about people that were contemporaries a generation or two before. And it's bridging those gaps that we may not be as different as we think. We just speak differently, express ourselves differently because of the times, and having that Mr. Keating, that guide, that mentor, that teacher that I've been lucky enough to have a few in my life, making it accessible for you to reach through those things. I think it's a beautiful thing in terms of seizing the day. But when it comes to conformity, I think this movie, like a really good poem, doesn't answer the question, but it poses it. Because when you see the headmaster, I don't think he's evil. He's deeply committed to what he believes is the well-being of these kids. We need to have these so we move forward. The Latin teacher, Mr. McAllister, he's also questioning these things because he doesn't think that they come. And we have to remember that these teachers, Mr. Keating as well, Kurtwood Smith, the guy from RoboCop, the dad from that 70s show, right, Red, he plays the father. He is, obviously he didn't come from money. He does talk about sacrifices that he obviously did have to make to have his son attend that school. And he's somebody that went through World War II, where the greater good was something that he strived for, and he's doing what he thinks is best for his son. And you see these subtle, he has this aggression towards Neil, and then you see this subtle, like almost shame in his eye where he kind of lowers, or he's like, oh, he kind of comes down and then comes back up and comes down, comes back up and comes down. And we can talk about the relationship with him and his son in a little bit. I don't think it says this is good or this is bad. I think it presents just enough to show that everybody's trying to do what they think is best. And I know that I'm biased towards Keating because I'm obviously more contemporary than the movie, and I'm very big on free thinking. But I don't think it's as simple as saying these guys are bad, the Dead Poets are good, and we need to move forward.
Right? Would Keating's methods be considered too much at a boarding school today? Or let's even say in the 80s, 90s. Would there be pushback at an institution today?
I think that one of the scenes that we love and we don't care about in case of him maybe overstepping is the scene, the improvisational scene with Ethan Hawke's character coming up with a poem. I don't think it'd be cool to have a teacher grabbing your face and shoving you around. But if that happens in the school today, for example, if that happened to my nephew, good or bad, you better believe my sister's paying a visit to the school. Just, I'm telling you, right now in contemporary society. So I don't know. What I do know is that he challenges these conceptions. What do you think, Deb?
He just lets loose and his heart leads him to do what he feels is the best for these boys. I mean, Keating went to that school. He started the Dead Poets Society. Mm-hmm. He was a mover and a thinker and a lover of literature. And
high achiever.
A high achiever. And he knew what this conformity was doing to him. And he didn't push it on the boys at first. I mean, he didn't really push it on them. They looked up in his yearbook and saw that he had formed this Dead Poets Society, and they pushed him a little. And then, you know.
That's a good point. Yeah, he put some breadcrumbs out, and they kind of,
He did leave him the book, though. He did leave him the book.
They were fascinated by what he was teaching them in class and his methodology and, like, what is this guy all about? And this whole, you know, seize the day, I think Keating he wants them to find their purpose, not just go along in conformity, living their lives, in an ordinary way. He wanted them to be extraordinary. And, of course, the school did not agree with his teaching. He was let go. They, you know, blamed what happened to Neil on his teaching, you know, this free thinking. This was a lesson for these boys like never before, and it was never experienced in that school, and he was the one. Yeah.
Something you said, Deb, made me think of this. If I really look at it, I think everybody here is doing what they think is right. Knox thinks it's right to go for this girl, even though he's kissing the forehead of a girl who's asleep and is somebody else's girlfriend. The father thinks it's right to have his son become a doctor and push him and remove him from our extracurricular activities. The boys think it's right to rebel. Mr. Keating, everybody thinks they're right. And I think the deeper meaning is the risk of poetry in a world that's conformist.
Now, how much of this is, would you have seen this perspective that you have of this movie now 30 years ago? Because some of what you're saying, I feel is us having experienced this a little bit more, coming at it this other side. Would the youth see it like that too, even watching this movie? Because I don't know, I did too. I agree with you. But the youth, are they giving them that side at the time? I don't think they are.
Well, I can tell you that for me, when I was younger, 30 years ago, I was 10, 11, when this movie came out. No, not even, 89? I saw it when I was 10. It was all about Mr. Keating, like the charisma of Robin Williams, having that mentor at that time when I was a young kid, like these big personalities. Yeah. I thought that was what this movie was about. Now that I'm older, to me, the most important relationship is Neil and Todd. I think that's the emotional crux of the movie now. And I can go into why later when we talk about them more, but it's definitely shifted my perspective, because I think when we're young, we think we're going to make so many connections, right? But as I get older, that's not the case. I still connect with people. I'm gregarious by nature. I'm open by nature. And I'm very lucky that I've made a friend in you, Scott, making a friend in you, Debbie. But those connections that are very deep, they're less than what you expect them to be when you're younger. So now with that frame, mm-hmm. I see that relationship between Neil and Todd as much more important and driven and almost symbiotic, and how they push themselves in the orbit of this larger than life persona of Mr. Keating, at least for me.
What did you think of the movie when you were 10 years old? I can't even imagine watching a movie like this when I was 10 years old. Sure. But I'm a different generation.
Did you theater it? Or do you think you?
Yeah. I was too young for theater. In 89, I think I was 6. So, and I was also an ESOL here. I learned to read very young. So I was reading poetry at a very young age. The ability to read poetry was there, but the subject matter, I was still a child. When I saw this movie, let's be honest, in the 1990s, our parents rented some. I saw Bloodsport over 100 times. I was like 6, 7, 8 years old watching Van Damme fight Chung Li, kicking him to the face. Okay. I don't think our parents back then took as much care to see what we were watching as they do now. And I can speak for
back in the day, those movies, when back in my day, those movies were not available. We were, you know, watching It's a Wonderful Life. And yeah.
Which I saw as well, which is a beautiful movie. But the way this movie was marketed, look at the trailer now. The way this movie was marketed was as this big, fun. There is nothing talking about the darker aspects of this film. When you look at the promotional materials, when you look at the interviews that were done, I mean, if you do, it's a Touchstone movie. Touchstone means Disney. And as a kid, Touchstone meant we're going to watch it. So when you get to the suicide at the end, it is.
Well, that's something. Yeah.
I had no idea as a kid. I don't know about you, Scott. I mean, we're about the same age or a little older.
Exactly. What about you? So I can't think I saw it at 10. I think it was more about 15, 16 were the first time I might have saw it. I had heard of it. Like, that was just at the time I was getting into theater. And like I mentioned in the beginning, it's so interesting that so much of this movie, I feel, got integrated into my own personality. But it wasn't conscious, really, you know, like I played the saxophone, you know, like, cause I just thought it was cool or whatever. I want my way through poetry was through Shakespeare, doing, you know, kind of a Shakespeare play. Yeah. Looking at it from that perspective, you know, we're talking, you know, suicide and, you know, I'm thinking of that now, having lost, you know, my brother-in-law recently to suicide. How to introduce that as a topic to a young person. And through this movie, is this an effective way for a child or for a teenager to experience that? I guess I'm still wrestling with it. As far as how it's displayed, I guess it's done, it's depicted somewhat tastefully on screen. You know, it's insinuated. There's kind of like the crown, you know, that has... you really get it, you know, almost in a Shakespearean manner, where you don't see the action, where you get it from the reaction of the other characters. That allows it to be, you know, a little bit, you to catch your breath a little bit. I think the key is to this can be a way to talk about it, but to have somebody to talk about it. And what I kept going to is Mr. Keating. Of course, he gave him the opportunity, you know, talk to your dad. And he was there to talk to him. And that part is tough for me to a little bit reconcile with, that he had that in Mr. Keating, whether he saw him as a source, that he had seemed like he had some other outlets with which to express himself. I guess he feared that they would have been completely taken away if he was shipped off to a different boarding school and that sort of thing. I just would like to believe, you know, that Keating did put out that olive branch, and he went about it the right way. If anything, you know, as a parent, that's how I would love to be able to talk to my child.
But Neil knew that his dad wouldn't budge. That's why he made up a lie to say that he did talk to him.
He saw through that lie, though. Like he you could tell he knew, he had a feeling.
A couple of things. Mr. Keating, great. He saw through that lie, but then he went and said, "Congratulations, you were awesome," in front of his dad too. He knew that he lied. And I do think that made it a bit worse. That's why he actually said, when the other guy, Charlie,
he's like, no, we don't make it worse. They'll make it worse. I'm like, dude, you made it worse. So I do see some stuff there. I think that Neil's real death was when he couldn't have an honest moment with his father. And even his father was saying, this is where I mean, where it complicates the whole who's evil, who's not, is like, well, tell me. Aggressive, yes, and all that, but just he just couldn't do it. I think Neil, going back to the relationship with Todd being from this high-achieving family, his family doesn't even remember what they gave him for his birthday. He feels like what it's inside himself is not worth it. Neil is the one who decided, like, I have empathy. I'm going to help him. I'm going to bring him out. I don't want to hurt anyone. I want to improve everybody's life. He didn't want to hurt his father. He only thought of hurting himself. But I think when he failed to have that honest moment with his dad,
his dream died.
That's where he died. Yeah. The suicide was almost ritualistic. Even the gun was in a wrapped cloth that looked like a ceremonial dagger.
Your heart drops as much during that part than...
Yeah, and it's funny because when I watched it originally, I knew he committed suicide, but watching it 10 years later, because I did see it in my 30s, right when I turned 30, I remember seeing it again, thinking, wow, this movie's great, and then I didn't watch it. I thought Todd was going to commit suicide because I remembered somebody committed suicide just because of his inability to love himself and think that what he has is worthwhile. I thought Knox was going to commit suicide because he said, if I'm not with her, I'm going to kill myself. I thought even Charlie was going to kill himself because of he was the only one who got paddled. He took the abuse. He's the one who didn't compromise. He's the one who left, right? He's the one who took the punishment. He's the one who acted out. Because Neil seemed to be the one who had the most together within the school, within his social sphere.
Then
it's him who couldn't make it. And it's such a, even back then, it's this commentary that, yo, mental health is important. And it's sometimes it's the ones who you don't think need help that need it the most. Mm. And it was super impactful for me.
Yeah. I always want to kind of zoom out to the film, you know, within life. Where you have these two young actors, you know, Ethan Hawke and Robert Sean Leonard, and you know there was a fire inside them having been the representations of these figures who seize their own days to follow their dreams. And boy, did they, where forming a theater company and that character, you know, who does take his own life in the movie as an actor, yes, he takes control of his life and is a accomplished, you know, Tony Award winning theater actor. Ethan Hawke, one of the best actors of, you know, our generation.
One of my faves.
However, or whatever, you have Robin Williams now, who continues to put out amazing films, but ends up taking his own life, I guess, 30 years after. And from what I've read, to highlight Renzo's point a little bit too, you don't know what people are going through. There's talk that he was going through a tough time during even the filming of that movie. And he's giving all of himself in that, but he had just gone through a divorce in real life, Robin Williams. Mm-hmm. He wasn't sure he was even going, you know, to be hired for this role. I saw they offered it to Liam Neeson and Mel Gibson, you know.
Dustin Hoffman.
And Dustin Hoffman. Right. So viewing it through those eyes, him not even knowing what he was doing, that he had, in addition to some physical pain that he was made aware of that was going to alter his life, you know, some mental threats that were also kind of crossing in some sort. So we don't know, and we don't even know if he knew exactly if he was of full mind and body when the act occurred. I don't know what to make of it, you know, looking at it through that lens now. And I know it's come up in other reviewings of this film. I don't know if there's a question here. I'm just kind of emoting, but there seems to be often of actors that appear in a movie that deals, you know, with suicide or have directed a movie that deals with suicide where years later or they end up also taking their life. Most recently, it also happened with the actor, the director, Jeff Baena, Aubrey Plaza's husband, who did this beautiful, heartwarming movie about suicide and dealing with kind of a friend of theirs that in real life had suicide called Joshi. And then he takes his own life. Can you make sense of that?
I have thoughts about people who commit suicide in the way that Robin Williams did, which was by hanging, or by Neil's way with the gun. Like, I know they're different. Robin Williams had an illness. When your family has to find you, unimaginable, when someone takes a pill, I think it's just more kind to their families, because it's just so hard. It's just, well, in any way, it's so hard. But I mean, you said something about Robin Williams maybe not thinking, or but when you plot and do something in that way, I don't know, I think you have thought it out.
I always equate it to sometimes, your wires are so crossed. His synapses are firing at a mile a minute in such a amazing way that they're firing, but they're not connecting in the same way that they're used to connecting. So like he has like a synapse, but it's going towards this, towards even a negative direction or some, you know, other dark place, as opposed to all this beautiful and kindness that he's used to, he's used to doing.
Yeah. Yeah. He was so amazing too. And his outreach for social justice, hiring homeless people on his sets. He was just, you know, a giver, just,
I guess where I stand on it is that's with the assumption that it's not a rational act, right? Like his synapses weren't firing. It's not what he meant to do. And I don't know, maybe sometimes they mean to do it. And I don't know what the level of desperation somebody must go through to get to that point, to feel they have no other recourse, right? I've lost people in my life. I've lost them violently, but I haven't been directly touched by suicide. I've been touched by suicide through friends and their loved ones. And I do think that at times they're in all use of their faculties and they see no other way. And that's that level of desperation that is hard to understand unless you've been there. I can't say that I've been there, but I can say that what I do try to do in my life is make sure that if I want to say something to someone, or if I notice that someone's off and I can find a way to bring it up in a way that's safe and accessible, like I try to do that just to say, hey, I'm here. And then they can take the choice. Because for example, like to bring it back to the movie, I think poetry is a key. With this society is represented as a jail, these pillars. Even at the end scene, when you see Ethan Hawke standing on his desk, he's framed by two legs, two pillars right there holding him in society. And poetry is a key. So you have writing poetry is a key for Todd to liberate himself. Acting is a key for Neil to liberate himself. Teaching is a key for Mr. Keating to liberate himself. For some reason, Neil didn't feel like he could grab that key, right? The key is there. That doesn't mean you're going to take it or not. It's difficult because I think it goes back to what I was mentioning, like this risk of poetry coming into a conformist world. Because, you know, as I mentioned, Neil is inspired by Keating and he wants to pursue acting and he loves it and he's good, right? He's a theater actor too, so it represents well on screen. But then this self-expression leads into a clash with his father, who's an authoritarian. And then his death casts a shadow over the idealism that society represents. And then you have Mr. Keating, who is this figure who personifies the poetic impulse, and then he's scapegoated, fired, and dismissed. Basically, where else is he going to teach? Basically exiled, or maybe London. And he's exiled for encouraging independent thought. And then Todd Anderson, who finds his voice through poetry, he's the one who's writing in notebooks and didn't think it was good enough until we get to a scene that we're going to talk about very soon. He finally stands up in defiance, but it's too late for Neil. It's too late for Keating. Keating's gone. Like poetry within society is, those are the dead poets in a way. I see that as those being the dead poets, because it's not that the boys stopped loving poetry, but society is killing it through fear, through discipline, through repression. And then also the title, maybe the poets are dead, but worse, poetry itself is being silenced by the living. And I'm not saying like that's the final view of it, but that's something that the movie presents. So you have an homage and a warning in this movie, right? And that's where that's how I'm making sense of this within the confines of the movie, if that makes sense.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about the performance of some of the poems within the movie before we hear a little bit from each of us, a poem that was inspired by the movie, one of which by Ethan Hawke's character, the first poem that comes out, where up until this point, he's pretty shy, reserved character, where you're not really getting a full sense of, you know, what is fully inside it. You see him brooding, and you have this amazing, powerful poem that is put forth. as Renzo had mentioned, with Robin Williams shamanistically, you know, drawing it out of him, but he's able to, you know, tap in. And in any event, it reminds me a lot of when you see somebody that, oh, they light up when they're on stage or when they're expressing themselves, they're deep into themselves. There's a big difference between, you know, the class clown and then, you know, like the star performer. Like the class clown's there to kind of like disrupt. But there is that student, you know, in class that, wow, you didn't necessarily see it in them. But when they're up there, they really draw you in. They light up a room. And yeah, I was just, I'm always moved by that. You see it from first time performers or, you know, seasoned performers. Now, there's also a way with which it's presented, you know, with the camera work as well that mm-hmm. Renzo wanted to kind of talk about as well. If you remember that scene in particular of what they're doing with the camera that really kind of creates a theatrical atmosphere.
I love this scene. You have just very quickly Ethan Hawke pretending he didn't do the assignment. Keating knows he's full of it and he's pushing him, right? And Robin Williams actually had a similar relationship with Ethan Hawke. Ethan Hawke was not going to break. He was being very serious. And like when he goes like, I know this scares you, you mole. That was ad-lib by Robin Williams to Ethan Hawke to try to get him to break. So all these little bullying and prodding and pushing, but that we see, I think I see it through the eyes of good natured, right? I don't see it through abuse of a kid. He has him go up and try to recite and he can't do it. And he's like, look at Whitman, right? Look at the picture of Whitman up there on the, look at him up there on the wall. What do you see? And he's like an old man. Okay, keep going. And the sweaty toothed madman, right? Great image. And then people laugh and he tells them, forget them, keep going. And it's this Ted Lasso coach. It's like, this is almost like a sports movie for poetry. This is Rudy for poetry. This is, you know, these great coaches. And then if you notice, the camera from Peter Weir is spinning around them dynamically as he's creating this poem of the blanket that covers your face and can't cover your feet and it's too cold and it just covers your face until you die, right? It's showing what he has inside him. And the way that it's filmed is incredibly dynamic. I love the camera work. I love the direction from Weir. I love the performance from Ethan Hawke, from Williams. That little smile he gives at the end of, oh my God, I did this. Was just enough to give you a glimpse into the character's inner world. Ethan Hawke was doing tremendous work here, and Williams was, I think, at his best, right? I would put this scene right next to the It's Not Your Fault scene from Good Will Hunting in terms of a Williams performance.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly powerful scene, which is then bookended again with Ethan Hawke and Robin Williams in the final scene. Debbie, I know you love this scene. Is there anything you want to say about maybe the scene I just talked about, or lead us into the discussion of the final scene? The boys were forced to sign an affidavit saying that this is, I mean, there's no cops doing this investigation, okay. But they're forced to sign an affidavit saying that this was all, basically it's Keating's fault, and he gets fired and dismissed. And there's this beautiful scene that's important that happens right before, where Keating is in his room gathering his things. And Mr. McAllister is outside walking with his Latin kids through the park, having class in a dynamic, looking up at Keating and waving. So even though he's leaving, he laid the seed to help other people change and be more dynamic, right? He affected this guy, McAllister, who he was sparring with. Now he's teaching his kids in a more dynamic way. Maybe it's not all the way, but it's just these little seeds that are being laid. And then the headmaster, who was an English teacher, is now teaching the class. He's trying to teach the boys, asking them where they are. He's like, oh, yeah, the pages are ripped. They're all ripped. All the books, forget it. Let's go. And Keating comes in and says, I just want to gather my stuff. And he tells him, get your stuff now. We go out. Ethan Hawke is ashamed. He looks at Keating, looks down because he knows he signed the affidavit. He feels like he betrayed his mentor. And as he's walking out, he's inspired and overcome by a moment of poetry and standing on the desk and saying, God, oh, captain, my captain, which is, again, bookended with the poem we read at the beginning of this podcast, because it's an oh, captain, my captain is an elegy for Lincoln, for Abraham Lincoln. His symbolic act is this elegy for his captain. It's almost as if he's dead in a way, like he's no longer with them. I can go on, but Debbie, I want to hear your thoughts on this scene.
They're mourning their hero. They've lost their leader, and it's paralleled with Abraham Lincoln in Whitman's poem, O Captain, My Captain. And as Keating says in the beginning, you can call me Mr. Keating or you can call me, oh, Captain, my Captain. And yeah, that made the boys chuckle. But after time passes, they feel the importance of this and the weight of this, the symbolism of Ethan Hawke getting up, the shyest one, the most reticent one, and he knew he had to redeem himself and he had to tell Mr. Keating that this is all wrong. But they were just boys and they were forced by their headmaster and their parents to sign this paper incriminating him. But he was still going to show that, you know, you are the one who has changed our lives. And it was Neil's father's fault. It wasn't your fault. And him standing up on the desk and then the others following in suit was the most chilling, incredible moment for me in the movie, of course.
It's beautiful. Probably what about you, Scott? What about you?
Yeah. Also, you know, quite inspiring. Important to note there are a few students that don't stand.
Yeah, that's it. It's half-half. It's half-half.
But were they in the Dead Poets Society, the ones who didn't stand? Because I don't remember that many of, there was just a smaller group.
So Richard, we haven't even talked about Meeks or Pitt, but
right.
Richard, he didn't stand. And other kids didn't stand, but the kid who read the poem stood. The cat poem that was short. He said, the original. Kid with the allergy stood. So it was half-half, which I think made it.
And that's realistic. I mean,
it made it more real.
Still maybe part of them skeptical or they're not sure, you know, like it's too new for them. They're not ready for it. The standing on the desk again, that you have to beware that because such a powerful symbol, what is the equivalent of doing that today, taking a stand, but it is on the desk.
But it's more than that because he had them stand on the desk to see the world from a different perspective.
Yes, so I think that's what it is, the perspective.
Yeah, exactly. And what they're telling us, because of you, shifted. I will look at things with a different perspective.
Oh my gosh, yes. Right.
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
Great point. Yeah, the high and the low, the different perspective, which I think leads perfectly into Debbie's poem that was inspired by this movie. If you would be so kind to share that with us.
Yes, I'm excited.
Thank you. Thank you, my captain, by Debbie Wanenkoff. Oh, captain, my captain, you unshackled the chains from my thoughts. Oh, captain, my captain, you opened the doors to my true emotions. Oh, captain, my captain, you released my spirit from bondage. Oh, captain, my captain, you set me on the path to self-discovery. Oh, captain, my captain, you saved me from mediocrity. Oh, captain, my captain, you have revealed the value of my life. Oh, captain, my world has ever changed. Oh, captain, my captain, I see the light, I see freedom. I will seize my extraordinary days.
Thank you, Debbie. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Scott, do you want to share your poem?
I was waiting for Debbie to stand on her desk too. But...
What?
Waiting for you to stand on the desk, right?
I felt it. I was ready. I have two. I'll do a shortened version of right off this. I had written this after the storming of the Capitol on January 6, 2021, using this as a jumping off point and kind of getting back to what we had said of, you know, working off of kind of whether it's parody or homage pieces based on, Captain, my Captain. I wrote, oh, Capitol, my Capitol, her Capitol, your Capitol, the Capitol. Outside our capital, an uphill battle slowly fought begins. The building weathers an attack the pres they sought not in. The courts in sesh of freedom bells perplexed. We the people are revolting. What follows? Why? With feet on desk, election stress, a democracy insulted. But oh, heart, 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 these seceding drops of red. Two boys in blue, three MAGA hats now dead. With memories of Teddy, Dwight, and Abe, will our republic fade? Capital C, capital's captive. Capital Siege, capital Captain. Capital C to shining sea. How did we weave these people outside our tapestry? Capital Cap and Crunch out to lunch, what a travesty. Where's the waves of grain and mountain majesty? How do friends become such enemies? Boys too proud and crowds in hoods assert supremacy. Meanwhile, Lady Liberty hides her eyes on bended colony between First Nation displacement, stops and immigration, slavery, racism, and a blatant mishandling of capital C, capital CV. A blind man could have seen the signs that even America the Beautiful gets ugly sometimes. Oh, Captain, my Captain, what would you have us do? Cut the Scylla bullshit. When they go low, we go haiku. And not hi-ku. Say hello to knowing facts, peaceful transition, pubs and Democrats. O capital, your capital. Capital L, capital loss, capital gains, capital cost, capital land of the free, home of the brave, capital boss. I was born in the USA, capital planet to capital earth from capital space. O capital, my capital, our capital is safe. O capital, your capital. Outside our capital, an uphill battle slowly fought winds down. The building weathered withstood attack. Someone else's time is now. Court back in sesh, the feds arrest. We the people are rejoicing. What follows now to clean up mess, less COVID deaths, a democracy has choices. But oh, heart, heart, heart. Returning mobs of red, we with mournful tread, the same captain walks the deck. Life, liberty, and there's still much more we must protect.
Beautiful.
Wow.
So yeah, the full poem you can catch up on Amazon. And Renzo, you want to do yours, and I'll do, well, let me, can I do another short one if you don't mind, or you want to
bring it on? We need a little silly.
I went to the woods because I was bit deliberately. On my neck, arms, and back, and only the essential facts of what means to be defibrillated had me knowing how I should act. To see if I could unlearn what life had to teach as a parasitic leech. Oh, what it is to not be alive, yet discover I had also not yet died. When you cease breathing and your heart stops beating, it'll be me leading the next Undead Poet Society meeting. All your pens have been infected by ink that's been spilled. Let me go out on a limb and say, I don't Shakespeare's without a will. I'm a Michael Jackson Pollock of thrillerless quills. And speaking of limbs, I could use some. You win some, you lose some. Carpe snooze them. Unmask fast. Watch me disease the day. I just don't effing care. Oh, Captain, my Captain Cook, you're cooked. It's all Shaun of the Dead air. World War Ozymandias. Once a colossal statue that's been tragically lost. I took the road by Cormac McCarthy and not the one by Robert Frost. Ask me how I got ahead. 28 days later, I had my first brainstorm and was sufficiently fed on a train to Bukowski-san. Watch where you tread and do not go gentle into that good night of the living dead. Undead Poet Society.
I love it. You know, I wrote one as well, and I was thinking about this movie. This movie stayed with me. Even if society overcomes art at times, what this movie told me is that the verse lives on. It lived on in the students who found their voices. Even if the institution silences one generation of poets like Mr. Keating, another will rise, right? Poetry survives because it finds more of us to live in. And as I said, I saw the movie as an homage and a warning, because it honors those who dared to speak the truth through verse, even though they were silenced or ignored. And I don't know if we can ever beat what society is, because we need foundations in order to excel. But I think the central question for me, and I wrote a poem based on this, is will we too let poetry die, or will we contribute a verse? Will I let poetry die, or will I contribute a verse? So I wrote a villanelle right here, and it's called Carpe Verbum, Steal the Wheels. So seize the word, carpe verbum, steal the wheels. Do not let wordcraft die without your verse. Society will cage both muse and child. Let truth and love still wheels and stop the hearse. The institutions of our father's curse, imagination's greatest works, compiled. Do not let wordcraft die without your verse. Our focus played solely upon the purse.
creative dreams sold cheaply, then defiled. Let truth and love still wheels and stop the hearse. Let spontaneity craft and deftly nurse the dreams of children lost and once reviled. Do not let wordcraft die without your verse, a mentor's sage advice, a play rehearsed. Bring mind and heart and soul to reconcile. Let truth and love still wheels and stop the hearse. So burn the land and rage at the perverse with imagery both civilized and wild. Do not let wordcraft die without your verse. Let truth and love still wheels and stop the hearse.
Yes.
Wow.
I wow. didn't make the connection earlier. I the word hearse too, I've always associated with rehearse as well. Like I rehearsed and rehearsed my Reverse of the Dead. I rehearsed my addiction and put my pen in instead, which the idea of, yeah, those two being being the comedy and tragedy of things, putting, you know, a rehearse and a hearse. So, yeah, very poignant and poetic conversation.
I think we did it again. Another perfect episode. Debbie, I just want to thank you for joining us. It's so always so fun to talk to you. You had so many beautiful insights into this film. Again, thank you so much for gracing us with your presence. I thoroughly enjoy having you around. So thank you for joining us.
I really enjoyed it really very much.
And I look forward to, yeah, in person or in poetry, seeing you at an event to come.
Okay, yeah. Me too.
So... with that being said, I'm Renzo del Castillo.
Got three T's Raven. Joined today by the DW, Debbie Wannenkoff.
And this has been Real Poets. See you guys next time.
Real Poets is produced and hosted by Renzo del Castillo and Scott Raven. Original music composed by Gabby Weitzenfeld. Episode art and visuals by the Real Poets team. New episodes come out every other Thursday. Hit subscribe, download the episode, and leave a review to help us grow. This has been a Real Poets production. And remember to always keep it real.